Before we get started, two things. Firstly, if you value this podcast and Guardian journalism, we need your financial support too. More of this a bit later, but if you're convinced, go to gu.com/give. And a quick message from our sponsor, Squarespace. For all you need to build beautiful websites, go to squarespace.com. Now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. As Britain's public finances head for a £58 billion Brexit black hole, the new Chancellor puts on a brave face.
An economy which has confounded commentators at home and abroad with its strength and its resilience since the British people decided exactly 5 months ago today to leave the European Union and chart a new future for our country.
Instead of a George Osborne punishment budget, Philip Hammond softens welfare cuts and holds down fuel duty. They're targeting the so-called jams, people just about managing. But what about the poorest? We'll get reaction and analysis from around Westminster. Also this week, a white supremacist is given a whole life sentence for the brutal murder of Labour MP Joe Cox. We'll hear from friends and colleagues working to carry on her legacy.
I still think that Jo's energy and her spirit lives on, and Alison and myself and many others will now carry on that work.
And we'll cross to France, where the race to become the next president took an unexpected twist this week as a tea-drinking Thatcherite becomes the new favourite. So we've just come outside of Parliament. Philip Hammond has delivered his first big financial statement, and in it, knocking 2.4% off the growth forecast by the end of the Parliament, perhaps as a result of the uncertainty around Brexit. There was an attempt to focus on just about managing families, money for broadband, for roads and rail, changing the taper rate on universal credit, something that Tory backbenchers have really wanted to see. The personal allowance will continue to rise. And a pretty big package on housing. Philip Hammond really broke with his predecessor, George Osborne. He dropped his fiscal targets. He was ready to borrow to invest. Sounded a bit more like Ed Balls. He threw in the odd joke for someone who's seen as a very serious man. He said there'd be no rabbit, but there was one.
This is my first autumn statement as Chancellor. After careful consideration and detailed discussion with the Prime Minister, I have decided that it will also be my last. Mr. Speaker, I am abolishing the autumn statement.
OK, we're on College Green, where all the broadcasters are hoping to talk to people. Let's see who we can find. There's Sajid Javid, the Communities and Local Government Secretary, who is the man who's now in charge of housing.
I've been very clear that this is my number one priority, getting more houses built throughout England. And what we saw just a few weeks ago when we had the Conservative Party conference, a big announcement there on accelerated construction and the Home Builders Fund. And today, yes, two big announcements. One is the helping to build more affordable homes, but also the infrastructure fund, the Housing Infrastructure Fund, £2 billion of fresh money into that to try and free up in local areas where houses can be built, but they just don't have the right infrastructure. As for letting fees, I think that's important as well, to try and show that you're doing everything you can to try and bear down on costs, but also transparency. There's a lot of people that when they go to rent a home, that they often are surprised by some of the charges that are presented to them, and those often come from the estate agents, and I just think that we should have a lot more transparency around that, and that's why I think it's a good measure too.
And it sounds like you're prepared to be a bit more interventionist in your policy, and also it sounds like you're really thinking about renters. Is that a shift, a deliberate shift of emphasis?
Well, housing policy already by definition is interventionist, because it's always the government that controls one way or another the planning permission that's required to build that new home. And I think there is a lot more we can do. And as for whether people are renting or buying, you know, I just want to get housing supply up. And, you know, people can decide for themselves what's best for them. But today, I think we just have a situation where under successive governments, not enough homes have been built. There's too many people thinking that they're never going to own their own home or be able to rent a decent home. And I'm going to do everything I can to help them.
Here's Johnny Reynolds, Shadow City Minister. Big reduction in the growth forecasts. What did you take away from that autumn statement?
Well, awful forecasts. Growth down, investment down, productivity down. You know, you'd expect a hit from Brexit. But what I think we didn't get a sense of from the Chancellor is what's his plan to tackle that problem, that uncertainty that we knew was happening. On investment, there's been a sort of a move towards Labour and recognising the need to borrow to invest. But the fiscal rules, which by my reading are actually looser than Labour's fiscal rules, don't allow for taking out investment spending. So it doesn't seem like the framework for investment has been put in place. And on the jams, the people just about managing, who had a lot of speculation going in, to go ahead with that cut to universal credit means that the people who go out to work on really low incomes are the ones who are going to be absolutely hammered by this statement today. And that just doesn't seem to fit with the rhetoric from the government, and it just doesn't seem to tally with trying to get a country where everyone can play a part in the economy.
And you don't think that the change to the taper eight, putting money back into another part of universal credit, is good enough?
No, it's a really important point, this. So what was cut in the last budget were the work allowances. That's the amount of money you get to keep before any money is taken away when you get additional earnings. What they've said today is they'll take away that money from that smaller amount at a slightly slower rate. So it's a good thing in itself, but if you're taking away the amount of money people can earn before that kicks in, well, actually, you're still hammering people. It means if you were going to be losing, say, £50 a week, you're now going to lose £47 a week. And I don't think people will thank the government for taking away that £47.
So with Heidi Allen, who has been one of the Conservative MPs really pushing for money to go back into universal credit, are you happy with what you heard?
I am. I mean, you're always a little bit disappointed because, you know, you dream for utopia, and I hoped we might have more. That being said, one of the angles we were taking was that to fund it properly, you could stop the increase in the tax allowances to fund it. So as it is, we've kept those tax allowances, which everybody, of course, will benefit from. And we've had £1 billion put into universal credit, plus increases in national minimum wage. So yeah, I'm pretty pleased with that. But we will keep pushing. You know, we need to see how the economy is going to pan out in terms of whether this group of people are going to need more support from us.
And what they've done is taken a huge amount out of what's known as the work allowance, the amount you can actually earn before you start getting your universal credit taken off you. Instead, they've reduced the taper rate, the rate at which benefits are taken off you, but only by 2%, 65 to 63%. Will people really feel that?
Well, you're right, it sounds tiny, but when you realise that 2% actually costs £1 billion, then you realise just what large sums that you're talking about. What will it mean in terms of difference? Well, for a single parent, it's around about £170 a year. For two earners, it's worth, I think, around about £400. So it doesn't feel like a lot of money, but if I was in those shoes and I had so little coming in, I'd take that £170 if I was a single parent, but know that we will keep pushing to try and get more if we can.
Jonathan Ashworth, Shadow Health Secretary. We all thought that they might do something big and bold, either on the NHS or social care. Even Conservative council leaders were pushing for it. What's your response to what really wasn't very much on those areas?
Well, it's extraordinary. I'm still can't quite believe it, that when everyone has been pointing out the severe underfunding of the NHS, everyone has been pointing out that the social care sector is in crisis, it's on the verge of tipping point. Lots of organisations, including the chief executive of the NHS himself, have been calling for extra investment in social care. We've been calling for extra investment in NHS and social care generally, and he's done absolutely nothing. Nout. Zilch. I mean, it is unbelievable, and I think it just—I think it shows you that when you see the scale of the crisis that is unfolding in the NHS and social care, it just tells you everything about the priorities of this Conservative government, that they're prepared to put money into building grammar schools in this autumn statement. They're putting money into saving a stately home, as welcome as that is, but are doing nothing for a social care sector. I think people are going to be shocked. I mean, what these Conservatives said is that they gave the money the NHS asked for. They haven't. They claim they're giving the NHS an extra £10 billion. I've got a letter here from the Statistics Authority, which was covered in your fine newspaper today, which points out that they are being misleading when they are saying they've put an extra £10 billion in. I mean, the NHS needs money. It is going through its biggest financial squeeze in its history. In fact, do you know something? By 2018, head for head, money in the NHS will actually be falling by 2018. That's what's going on in our NHS. We won't stand for that. We won't allow that. But that's what's happening to the NHS under the Tories.
So one of the things that's going to happen now is various groups will race to analyse the budget as quickly as they can. And the Resolution Foundation reckon they're going to be first putting out their information today ahead of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. I'm joined by a senior policy analyst there, Laura Gardiner. Laura, what's the overall theme that we need to take away from this? Is it that massive Brexit black hole?
Well, the headline story today is undoubtedly the change in the economic outlook and what that means for the public finances. So higher inflation, slower growth, and therefore much higher borrowing over this parliament to the end of the forecast. Now, a lot of that's about Brexit, maybe up to around half of the higher borrowing, but it also reflects the fact that the Chancellor's chosen to actually ease the path of deficit reduction further by putting more into infrastructure investment, which is sensible given the uncertain times our economy is in. So that large deterioration in the public finances, higher borrowing, not hitting George Osborne's surplus target is absolutely the key message from today.
And £58 billion of that borrowing, you're talking about £122 billion altogether. They've put that amount down to Brexit. Can you explain to us what it is about Brexit that means we're going to have to borrow more?
Well, we should say that economic forecasts are always uncertain, but today they're probably even more uncertain because we don't know what type of Brexit we're going to have, let alone what effects that Brexit is then going to have on the economy. But well, one thing we can be fairly certain about is higher inflation, and that's because of the large fall in the value of sterling we had immediately following the referendum decision and then carrying on through the summer and autumn. And that is that kind of deterioration in the value of the currency is well known to kind of feed through into inflation. Higher inflation means lower living standards for households.
Okay, well, let's talk about households. I mean, they talked a lot in the run-up to this autumn statement about the so-called jams, people who are just about managing. Philip Hammond would argue that reducing the taper on universal credit, banning letting fees, putting £1.4 billion into affordable homes, putting money into transport, putting money into broadband is all about the jams. Do you think that these are big measures?
Well, there's definitely some welcome news on things like banning letting agents' fees and more investment in house building. These things are really welcome. But particularly when we look at the kind of direct tax and benefits that affect households, what we have today is Philip Hammond missing an opportunity to do anything significant to help the just about managing families. The decision he's made on universal credit, slightly reducing the taper, is of course very welcome, but it doesn't come near to addressing the effects of the very large cuts to in-work support that his predecessor put in place. So in terms of scale, it's getting nowhere near to softening the blow of previous policies on just about managing families who are in work, these cuts to in-work support, as well as the impacts of the worsened economic outlook on their earnings and the effect that higher inflation has on them. So while lots of the steps he's taken are welcome and some of the longer term decisions on things like infrastructure should benefit households in the long run, in the short term, for the just about managing, today is a missed opportunity.
Laura Gardner, thank you very much.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/Guardian.
So I'm joined by The Guardian's other political editor, Heather Stewart, James Plunkett, Director of Policy at Citizens Advice, and Andrew Jimson, Boris's biographer and a man who works for Conservative Home. Heather, let me start with you. What is the kind of main thing we should take away from today?
Well, this was the first chance we got to get a sense of how big a hole Brexit is likely to blow in the economy. So the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility has done its sums. Of course, we don't know what kind of Brexit we're going to get yet, but certainly they expect growth to slow over the next 2 or 3 years, and the total impact on the public finances is about 60 billion quid over the course of this parliament. So that's your Brexit black hole, which Philip Hammond had to announce. And I think that was the overarching message, really. I mean, there wasn't... They had told us there weren't going to be any rabbits out of the hat, and there weren't, really. There weren't any or many sort of theatrical gimmicks. It was a very sort of matter-of-fact statement, it seems to me.
Yeah, the rabbits all seemed to hop out of the hat last night so that Philip Hammond could do the image that he wants to do. I noticed, in fact, John Crace, our sketchwriter, noticed that there were 10 Remainers in a row around Philip Hammond. as he delivered the news of the Brexit black hole. Do you think that he was kind of trying to build a fence of steel so that people couldn't have attacked him on that point?
He certainly, I think, saw the forecast and the OBR as sort of very carefully spelled out in its big fat report exactly how it thinks Brexit will affect the economy. And he sees that as justifying some of his caution, I think, and some of his concerns about the risks of different kinds of Brexit deal, which we know some other cabinet members have been much more relaxed about and, in fact, feel that he's too pessimistic and a bit Eeyore-ish and sort of is talking the economy down.
A bit Eeyore-ish, I like that. James, what did you think of this? We've heard a lot about the jams, the just about managing. I mean, a lot of those people are the type of people who get in touch with Citizens Advice. Will they be feeling happier today?
I think that's right. So they're often the clients that come to us, certainly the working clients that come to us for advice. I think the interesting thing in a way for that group today was to focus on the consumer issues. And we saw the ban on letting agent fees, which is a slightly unusual thing to have announced in an autumn statement in some senses. But that sort of came out of this hole the government finds itself in, where the finances were so bad, but they'd committed so clearly to helping this group of just managing families. And in a way, that kind of idea of intervening in consumer markets, cutting bills, letting agent fees, energy market was mentioned again today, seems to be their kind of way through that one of helping those families in a world without much money around.
And what about the people below the jams? Were they thought about at all? I mean, Theresa May's talked about people earning 18, 19 grand and more. What about people earning less than that?
Yeah, I think that's a big question being asked. This jams group that we're talking about, people tend to talk about the second to fifth deciles, so as in the bottom half, but not the bottom 10%. That tends to be the focus of the government when they're talking about this group. So there's that question, are they therefore ignoring the bottom half? And certainly we didn't see the kind of U-turn that some had hoped for on universal credit today. There was a bit of a softening of that cut, but not the full U-turn some had hoped for. So people will keep asking, I guess, in coming months, are these kind of consumer interventions going to feed down to that bottom 10% as well?
And Andrew, interventions, I mean, that's what it felt like, a little bit more interventionist, perhaps a little bit less Tory-ish. Do you think that?
Well, I think he's dry as dust underneath all this stuff. I mean, he did have one or two sort of rhetorical flourishes, including, I thought, a very, very quite unnecessary joke about Boris Johnson.
I suspect that I will prove no more adept at pulling rabbits from hats than my successor as Foreign Secretary has been at retrieving balls from the back of scrums. But my focus...
He and the Prime Minister are making a habit of this. They shouldn't be making fun of the Foreign Secretary. I'm quite indignant about that. I think it's uncollegiate. Boris, on one occasion, when he was asked if he wanted to be Prime Minister, he said if the ball came loose from the base of the scrum, then he would, of course, pick it up and go for the line, which was a sort of vivid analogy, but it has no place in an autumn statement, I think.
There's one time that we all laughed, Andrew. I mean, James, do you, at Citizens Advice, actually look at this and think, Philip Hammond maybe could be a bit more like a Labour Chancellor maybe than George Osborne? I mean, is it a pleasing break from the past?
I mean, I certainly think back on this question of consumer markets and sort of willingness to intervene when these markets aren't working for people. And the energy market is the other big one that's on their to-do list. And they said again today that remains something they're going to look at in the coming weeks. So to that extent, there's a bit of kind of cross-dressing going on here, a bit of stealing some of those previous ideas that even Ed Miliband floated. Labour said again today that it was them that said the letting agent fees ban idea first as well. So in that sense, the budget kind of cut through to that group of voters maybe more than you might have expected.
Yeah, I mean, OK, Heather, on letting agents, not only did Ed Miliband come up with it, when he came up with it, the Tories broke into laughter. They thought it was ludicrous. They said it was a part of a package of Venezuelan-style reforms. Even in September, the now housing minister, Gavin Barwell, said, bad idea, rents are going to go up. What's going on here?
It is extraordinary. I think it's two things. It's partly trying to do something, as exactly the same James said, trying to do something for people lower down the income scale without actually having to spend any money on doing it. So that's a bit of it. But also, you know, Theresa May's made very clear, she certainly did in her conference speech, that she thinks the government can play a more interventionist role in markets. I think she felt perhaps that the Cameron government was a little bit too laissez-faire, a little bit too laid back about these things and too doctrinaire about not interfering. And she's made very clear, she if she thinks the market isn't working properly, she'll get in there, to the horror of some businesses, it has to be said.
And Andrew, let's talk about Theresa May and Philip, the big new pairing. Do they work together very differently than George and Dave used to?
Well, there's a completely different feel to it, isn't it? Isn't there? I mean, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, if you take the two of them together, they're 25 years older than the people they replaced. An older generation. This is Oxford of the 1970s, unglamorous, provincial England, and in many ways all the better for it, and no problems about ever having belonged to the Bullingdon Club.
So, Heather, what does the difference in between the way that number 11 and number 10 work together mean? I mean, does Philip Hammond really have a free rein? I mean, is he in there in the meetings? Does he know what's going on? And to what extent do you think he had to do Theresa May's bidding, for example, over softening the blow, even if only slightly on universal credit?
So I think there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and quite a bit of negotiation like that about that. I think it's more of a traditional number 10, number 11 relationship. I think there isn't that chumminess. There isn't that sense that the pair are part of a political project together, which you got with Cameron and Osborne. You know, they would sit together in the 8:30 meeting every morning and Osborne had his finger in all kinds of different pies. This is a much more traditional, you know, Prime Minister says, can't we do something that will sound jazzy in the autumn statement? And the Chancellor says there isn't enough money, which is, you know, kind of the Treasury's old-fashioned role. So I think they have a more formal and traditional approach than we've seen in recent years.
OK, and Andrew, you're going to get the final say. Just tell us, how did Philip Hammond do today, despite that horrible joke about Boris?
I thought he did quite well. At one point he said, it's complicated, but I'm telling you it's good. It was like having your personal sort of finances explained to you by a competent accountant, and so vaguely reassuring. Even the Labour people on the whole listened quite respectfully to him.
Fantastic. Vaguely assured by a competent accountant, but he didn't cover everything. Heather, James, Andrew, thank you. Now we have a small favour to ask. More people are reading and listening to The Guardian than ever, but far fewer are paying for it. And advertising revenues across the media are falling fast. So you can see why we need to ask for your help. The Guardian's independent, investigative journalism takes a lot of time, money and hard work to produce. To fund our journalism, go to gu.com/give, and together we can keep the world informed. As Philip Hammond was getting to his feet, we had the verdict in the Joe Cox murder trial. Thomas Mayer sentenced to a whole life sentence for a killing that the Crown Prosecution Service said was an act of terrorism. The message from her husband, Brendan Cox, was that this murderer would not silence Joe. And I'm going to go and find two of her colleagues and friends who are continuing her work. So I knew Jo Cox before she was an MP, and also got to know her better when she came in here. And one of the last conversations I had with her, she talked about the two areas that she was most passionate about and that she wanted to focus on during her time as an MP. One of those was protecting civilians in Syria. And the other was what she wanted to do was set up a loneliness commission to look at loneliness in the UK. Alison McGovern and Rachel Reeves are two Labour MPs who were very close friends of Jo and who are now carrying on her work. Ali, you're particularly focusing on her work in Syria. You're going to be the co-chair of the all-party group looking into civilian protection. Tell me what you feel about the verdict and what we've heard about why and how Jo was killed.
Well, the first thing is, you know, how she was killed is insignificant in comparison to how she lived. She was a person who was absolutely determined and who never, you know, gave up on the causes she believed in. But I think what we have to realise is clearly there is, in some small way, there is this hatred in our country. And I think that the response to that is the one that I would like to think that Jo would want us to give, which is to say that we will not give in, we stand firm to our values, and that we will, you know, meet this attack on our principles with feeling even stronger that we're right to care about people and look after each other, and that we won't give in to the kind of disgraceful ideology that clearly is still there in our country.
Rachel, the CPS said that this was an act of terrorism, so clearly a political act. How do you feel that Parliament should respond to it?
Well, the murder of Jo was an attack on our democracy, and Jo's murderer wanted to silence Jo and everything that she believed in, and yet paradoxically the exact opposite has happened and more people have heard Jo's voice and what she stood for. And so in that way, the murderer did not win. He preached hatred and had hate in his heart, but Jo had love in her heart, and the response to Jo's murder has been an outpouring of love. And as Alison has said, it's incredibly important that we, Jo's friends and her family and her colleagues, now continue her work. Jo's now not here to take forward the campaigns that she believed so passionately in and gave so much energy to, whether that was Syria, loneliness, autism, all of those things that Jo campaigned for. We've now got to take on those campaigns and give the same sort of energy and enthusiasm and zest into them that we know that Jo would have done.
And can you tell me about the Loneliness Commission that you're now going to co-chair? Typical, Jo would always do things cross-party, so you're going to be co-chairing this with a Conservative MP.
Yes, so before Jo was murdered, she set up a commission on loneliness, and Jo was chairing that commission, and Seema Kennedy, who's the Conservative MP for South Ribble, was the vice chair of that commission. And after Jo died, Seema approached me and asked if I would take on co-chair with her of the commission. And in the same way that Jo was persistent, by the end of that day, I had had various lobbies from Jo's friends and family to take on that role. And by the end of the day, I was indeed co-chair of that commission. And I like to think that there was, a part of Jo continuing in her vein with that enthusiasm and energy and making people do things. And that is really, wasn't Jo by herself making the change, but Jo brought people with her. She had an infectious energy and enthusiasm that got us all, really. And even after she's been taken away from us, we'll now carry on that work.
Alison, Ruth Price, who was an assistant working with Jo, said to me that she wasn't always rational. She, you know, if she really felt something, she would go with it. She came here thinking she might do a lot on the Northern Powerhouse, and then the refugee crisis happened. And after that, we heard, she talked passionately about Syria. Can you just tell us a bit about the work that you're going to continue?
You know, one of the last moments I remember being in the house with Jo was when we were questioning the defence secretary on Assad's crimes against his own people in Syria. And typically of Jo, she would, that, you know, there was a team of us who were working on this issue and who were trying to raise the profile of civilians in Syria. And I saw she was in the chamber. She always led on this issue because she just clearly had such a passion on it. And I just looked over my shoulder and she mouthed to me, you know, what are you going on? What are you going to ask on? And I remember saying Assad's war crimes and her nodding and saying, I'm going to go for strategy. And that kind of like behind the scenes working with others that people don't see was exactly how Jo functioned. And like Rachel was talking about her ability to work cross-party, you know, before Jo was in the house, I knew her from, you know, sort of international aid world. And, you know, I'd been questioning Andrew Mitchell on different things for 5 years. And honestly, she got more done in a year by working across the house and finding common cause with Tories than I had opposing them for 5 years. And so we have to try and continue in that vein. You know, we have to try and learn from her and the way she did things. There's kind of unseen bonds that she built between people. She made a team of people that cared about Syria, and we have to keep that team together and, you know, keep doing things hopefully a little bit more like Jo would have.
And she did have this funny little relationship with Andrew Mitchell. Who would have thought? He called her a 5-foot bundle of Yorkshire grit. Just, you know, forgetting everything in Parliament, thinking of her as a mum and a friend. How would you sum her up?
I will never forget her smile. She was funny, impish, and she loved her kids.
Well, it was her energy, really, that I will always remember, and her approach to life. So much energy, a real zest, and an infectious sense of enthusiasm, but also a persistence to get things done. And I think if, in her memory, we could all live a bit more like Jo, then the world would probably be a better place.
A massive loss. Thank you both for joining us. Now, the 2016 upheaval in global politics continued this week with another big upset, this time in France. The national primary for the centre-right was expected considered to be a straight race between Alain Juppé and the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy. But the first round was stolen by François Fillon. Fillon, a former prime minister, is now favourite to win the nomination and to become the next French president. I called our correspondent in France, Angélique Chrysaphis, and I asked her why no one has been talking about Fillon until now.
Yeah, we weren't talking about François Fillon because he's a bit of a dark horse, but all the while he was kind of creeping up on the inside leg. He loves racing driving metaphors because he's an amateur racing driver. So, I mean, we did see this coming in the polls for the last week, but I don't think anyone forecast the actual level of support he would shoot up with in a couple of days. But as we know at the moment, a week is a long time in politics.
So do you think that despite the massive lead he had over Alain Juppé in the first round, he may not be the final candidate?
I think at the moment, anything could happen, but at the moment, François Fillon is definitely the favourite to be the Republican candidate and therefore to be the next president. We always have to be cautious. There's 6 months to go. But the point about Fillon is what he represents. He's this kind of old school, traditional provincial right. He's been in politics for decades and decades. He was prime minister under Nicolas Sarkozy. He represents this kind of traditional Catholic right, who lives in a 12th century castle with his five children and his Welsh wife. And he's running on a ticket of pro-business reform. He says that France is living above its means. It's practically bankrupt. It's got to turn things around. He loves Margaret Thatcher. And he says it's time for a sort of electric shock for France. And he's been known as really, he's been called Mr. Austerity. If you think you've heard this before, it's because you have. It's because he was prime minister when Nicolas Sarkozy was president. And this, to a lesser extent, is what Nicolas Sarkozy was promising in 2007, but what he didn't deliver.
Do you think, therefore, that François Fillon is politically to the right of Sarkozy?
Well, Alain Juppé is more of a centrist, more of a moderate. So we're talking about economic programmes here that are very similar because this is the same party. But what is going to be very interesting in the presidential race is this economic idea and this idea of free market reform. Because the French right have never been a free market right. This idea of Margaret Thatcher is making people quake in their boots. You've got to think of France in terms of this idea, this country with a massive welfare state and a big social model that it's always managed to hang on to, regardless of what was going on with Thatcher and Reagan. So it's this idea of protection, protecting the people. The economy is not an end in itself. The economy is part of protecting your people from recession and from the outside world. And France is really keen on hanging on to that. So if François Fillon is to be the rights candidate, he's going to be pushing this idea of free market, cutting public sector jobs. He wants to cut 500,000 in 5 years. The left, which is in absolute ruins in France at the moment with not a hope, the left is going, great, we can at least try and unite against this free market, crazy, ultra conservative guy. And meanwhile, in the background is Marine Le Pen from the far right Front National. She is going to be in the second round. We believe all the polls indicate that she'll be in this final two-person runoff for the French presidency. And if Fillon is the candidate against her, that's going to be very interesting. Marine Le Pen is very left-wing economically at the moment, so she's very into protecting this welfare state, state intervention, state protectionism, which is, of course, the Trump idea. So she's going to be in the background fighting on that. It will be a little bit difficult for her because François Fillon is not, he doesn't have corruption hanging around him and a history of legal cases like the other candidates have had on the right. And he's also obviously stepping on her territory with this idea of Christian roots of France. So it's going to be interesting to see how things shape up.
And we haven't even touched on François Hollande. Does he not have a chance at all? And what about Emmanuel Macron?
Right, well, François Hollande, he's recently got to the point where his satisfaction rating is 4%, which is pretty incredible. And yet, he's currently seriously considering, he hasn't made his mind up yet, but he's seriously considering running again for president. It's going to be very, very difficult for the left. Emmanuel Macron is a centre-left. He comes from the left. He was Hollande's finance minister. He's a former banker with no sort of politics background, never run for election. He's going to run for election in this kind of amazing maverick outsider sort of candidacy because he claims that all the other parties are rubbish and the political system is failing and that France needs something new. It's going to be very difficult for him. He doesn't have a party apparatus behind him, which is his whole reason for being, but it also makes things very complicated. Nothing is going to become clear until in a few weeks' time, François Hollande says whether or not he's running. And then after that, who does or doesn't replace him as a left-wing candidate. Macron is an unknown quantity. We don't know how well he could possibly do. There's a real, the French presidential election has never been this open 6 months beforehand. And I think there's, we can presume absolutely nothing.
Angélique Chrysaphis there in Lyon. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you have many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design, so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.